You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Amy Williams. Amy, it's good to have you here this morning.
It's great to be here.
So the way the show begins is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the qualities you aspire to live by, the things you've done, the labels you wear, to start the conversation?
Yeah, so, well, I think to start, I'm a person devotion of faith, mm-hmm. faith in Jesus Christ. I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and I love my faith. I'm a sort of in connection with that. I do research. We'll maybe come to this later about genetics, human genetics.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And I really love that work. But for me, the overriding desire of who I want to be is a disciple of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? How does that make a difference in your life?
Yeah. So that's a great question. I mean, it means that I seek to do good to my fellow beings, that I seek to understand them and love them where they are, and also seek to become a better person.
Right.
In connection with that.
And by good, is that good in their eyes, or good in God's eyes, or good in your eyes, or how do you...
Yeah. So, hopefully most questions that we might ask in that mm-hmm, domain
sure.
are fairly... simple to answer, you mm-hmm. know, being kind, being loving,
right.
You know, we're going to agree that that's a good thing in pretty much anybody's eyes.
Sure.
I feel like beyond that, it's hard to know just, I guess the question is, where do the conflicts come in?
Right, and what's driving the conflicts?
Right. And I guess, if I feel like, you know, I do, I don't know if this is exactly what you're getting at, but I do like to talk about my faith.
Mm-hmm.
But if I sense or someone expresses that they're not interested, then then I'll, pull back and maybe, let them have their space.
Right. No. And that really wasn't what I was getting at, but I can see how that would be, how you would interpret it, especially as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is known for proselytizing.
Absolutely.
And that can be hard-edged, or that can be just very gentle and sharing, and the difference is huge.
That's right.
Both in terms of morally and also just in terms of how it feels relationally.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So we're gonna dig into some of these things a little deeper, including your work in genetics, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But you brought some music with you. What would you like to open with?
Yeah, so... I really like, you'll hear there's a variety of music, but they're very sort of spiritual, and three out of the four are Christian. So the first is O Come, O Come, Emmanuel by the Piano Guys.
Here we go.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Amy Williams. So Amy, given the life that you've come to value and the things you aspire to live, what did you have to go through? What did you have to learn about yourself and about the world in order to kind of know how to live this life?
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like trials really shape us, mm-hmm. you know, and early on in college, I got very depressed. I was really struggling personally and just was not happy, not well. And I had always had my faith as a central part of my life to that point. But at that time, and partly because of interactions with others who had really challenged my faith, really, mm-hmm. you know, even said I was brainwashed and such.
I assume you were going to a non-religiously affiliated school, or that kind of comment wouldn't happen quite so.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. I was at the University of Utah, mm-hmm. which is it's a secular school, and there's plenty of members of my church there, and there's a good number.
Plenty or not.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so, and I love having friends of, you know, all kinds of persuasions, and enjoyed talking with these friends, but it was a very complex time to feel as unhappy as I was and to start feeling like I wasn't so sure that what I had believed all my life was true. Mm-hmm. And so I really sort of took the promises made in by the leaders of my church and by the Book of Mormon seriously. And I said, okay, if this is true, then I can study these books of scripture, the Book of Mormon, and I can pray and I can come to know by spiritual manifestations that this is real and that God is there and that no matter what happens, it's going to be worth it in the end.
And so that study took you deeper into a spiritual path.
That's right.
So what about that study? How did that study address your depression?
Yeah, so the depression was multifaceted, but partly it was about, you know, I'm uncomfortable. I'm really not happy right now. Is it worth it, right? And is there hope, right?
Is it worth it to continue your studies or to continue? Or what was the worth oriented toward?
Is life worth it?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay,
and
so basic.
Yeah. And is there really hope? Right. Mm-hmm. I couldn't see a way that it was going to get better. That the depression was going to leave.
Right.
And I think sometimes when we're young, I mean, I was 18 at the time, so not really young, but not. You know, that's. I feel like, yeah, it's easier to get to those places when we're about that age. And so, the spiritual manifestations that came as I really sought for God's influence in my life gave me an incredible amount of hope. I started to feel warm feelings as I opens the books of scripture and prayed and felt that God was real and that I had worth and that things would eventually get better. It didn't seem like they did for a long time, but those were the feelings that I had.
Right, right. And you could, I guess, so how did that feeling that things could get better enter your reality even when you were not there?
Yeah, right.
How did you perceive that? How did that come to your awareness?
Yeah, well, it was, you know, I would spend a lot of time in prayer. I mean, it was hard to be productive. I derive currently and previous to that time a lot of joy and satisfaction in I guess you could call it work, but sort of engaging in some deep activity that mm-hmm. you can get lost in. And I had enjoyed that, but at that time pretty much nothing gave me that feeling. And so instead I channeled that energy into my spiritual practice. And when I wasn't actively doing that, when I was in class, when I was, you know, attempting and still able to do homework, but struggling.
Hanging on.
Hanging on.
And when grades are dropping. And
yeah. when I wasn't in that space, it was hard, and I would sometimes think and try and focus my mm-hmm. energy on those experiences and those times. But other times I'd just be looking forward to, okay, in a few hours, I'm going to like go back to this more really focused study of scripture and, mm-hmm. and of prayer.
So one of the things about human beings is just physical critters. Seeking behavior is enormously gratifying, yeah. especially if you feel like it. There's anything productive coming from it. If it's not thwarted and you don't end up with frustration or anger.
Right.
But the seeking behavior itself is very satisfying. So what did you do? What actually did you do in your study? And was it alone or was it with groups or how was this reflection?
Yeah, it was just me. Mm-hmm. It varied. I liked, Salt Lake City, which is where I was living and where I was born and raised, the suburb of Salt Lake City, is there's mountains right, you mm-hmm. know, within a short drive of downtown and Salt Lake City. And so I would drive up in the mountains and sort of be in nature mm-hmm. and read scripture and pray. That was one of the key things. But if for whatever reason I didn't go on those drives, then I would just do it at home. And mm-hmm. But pretty much, yeah, on my own. But I would attend church as well.
Sure.
And yeah, all that.
And when you talk about reading scripture and praying on it, what was that? What was prayer in that setting?
Yeah. So I was talking with a friend, and she asked, she's struggling. She's younger than me, but struggling right now with trying to figure out what she should do with her life. And I think asking a lot of people, and she was asking me, what do you pray? What should I ask? Mm-hmm, sure. And like for me, I don't feel like my prayers are very refined. Mm-hmm. Like,
no.
I'm hurting, like, please help,
Right.
And it's just really just the feeling and just as real as I can be with Heavenly Father.
Right. And this is where a lot of people who don't understand prayers that are verbalized, what you just described is primary speech, the language of raw either need or joy or fear but the raw emotional statement of something that is kind of what's called primary speech and prayer language. And it's not about the fancy flowery
yes.
stuff. But it's also another way to get into the centered space that meditation or prayer without words
yep.
can do.
That's right.
But for you, it was with words.
That's right. This is my feeling. I don't know what I could back this up with, but, I think that our emotional, we can say a half-hearted set of words that mm-hmm. with deep feeling would be, in my view, much more effective, much more meaningful, mm-hmm. and that God would be more likely to answer. And so it's both the words, but it's also the deep desires and the...
Right. It's where they align with the emotion, and I would also add with your physical, visceral response. So you're moving as you're emoting, as you're saying, they all come together.
That's right.
And in those states of being fully engaged, we are open.
Yeah, that's right.
We're open to God or the universe or whatever you want to call it.
That's right. Yeah, for me, I felt so heavy and so unhappy, and these friends that had called me brainwashed, I really took that to heart, not saying that I believe them, but wanted to know, wanted to work out, are they right?
Right.
And, for me, the spiritual feelings, for lack of a better word, that mm-hmm. came in response to those efforts was, something very different from anything that I could access inside myself. I became certain I became certain that that God was speaking to me, because it was nowhere inside me. Those feelings were not there.
Right. And the certainty, when you use that term, it doesn't what I hear is not just the intellectual being convinced, but really more, here I stand, I can do no other. This is just the way it feels to me.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And it's interesting because I am a scientist, and I love engaging intellectually with questions of all mm-hmm. kinds, including questions of faith. So, not to shun that, but I feel like there's a way that these things can be unified. Not to say there can't, there's going to be, I hope one day after this life.
They can be
life,
held together.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Right. And what I hear you ambling toward, but not really saying, and what I've noticed is that many scientists, because they know they're practicing a discipline, the techniques are not reality. The techniques help you get at something, measure something that is beyond the technique or the tools themselves.
Sure.
But you have to have the discipline in order to get it.
Yeah, sure, sure. Yeah.
And in the same way, the study of scriptures, and whether they're Eastern or Western or Christian or right. or whatever, is a discipline. And you learn the tools of that discipline, not so that you can replicate the tools, but so that you can get beyond them.
Yeah, yeah.
And in that, the practice of faith and the practice of science from that perspective are parallel.
Yeah, yeah. They are tools. They are means to an end. They are,
or means to opening up
yep.
an awareness that may not even be an end, but maybe just awesome.
Sure. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's goal oriented because you're seeking it, but what you find is nothing you can control or manage.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Let's cut to music again. What should we play next? And then come back to your practice as a scientist.
Yeah, so I guess, as I feel now, very much a sense of joy. Not constant, but mm-hmm. much more so than I ever dreamed possible. Maybe the How Can I Keep From
sure,
Singing
sure, sure.
by Enya.
Yes, and that's a beautiful, beautiful song.
My life goes on in endless song, above earth's lamentation. I hear the real though far off hymn, the tales I knew.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Amy Williams. So, Amy, tell us about your practice as a scientist. What is it? What is your area of interest? How did you discover it? What keeps you involved in it?
Yeah, so my background is in computer science, and mm-hmm. I started grad school intending to do very traditional computer science and sort of helping software engineers do better at their work.
Sure.
Found that to be harder than it might sound. I couldn't see how, you know, I think there are people having an impact in that discipline, but I couldn't see how my work was going to do it.
Right.
And as a result, the long story short, I took a genetics class and just fell in love with it. And my advisor at the time suggested that I start to think about programs, source code for mm-hmm. software, as if it was DNA. And I wasn't sure what to do with that, but skipping a lot of details, eventually, you know, partly through his awareness, I got a co-advisor and I started actually writing software to analyze genetic data and to, you know, infer the way DNA gets transmitted from parents to children.
Sure.
Did a couple postdocs and just really enjoy stuff that's applied to life.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
Even though it's fun to talk about this stuff with people, I feel like everybody can relate at mm-hmm. least somewhat, and you know, even a fair bit to DNA and all that stuff. So, but specifically, you know, since coming to Cornell, a lot of the work that I and those that I'm working with have been doing is related to genealogy and mm-hmm. to finding relationships, you know, genetic relationships among people. Mm-hmm. My background is my training during my postdoc was in population genetics, and mm-hmm. there a lot of the questions are really deep human history, the out of Africa event, and mm-hmm. and how humans migrated over tens of thousands of years ago.
Sure.
But now we're thinking about and working on, you know, the last few hundred years, and how to classify relationships. Can we detect it, and how well from genetic data? And this is really, you know, I find it interesting, just irrespective of anything related to my faith, but
it's also kind of at the heart.
It is. So, you know this, but just to make sure everybody's on the same page, our church, does work on genealogy,
and they have some of the biggest databases around in terms of what people can access.
That's right. So FamilySearch.org is a free, you know, website that people can use to do mm-hmm. very traditional genealogy. So we, you know, if we want to find out about our ancestors, we find written records of people, and that can be very effective. But sometimes it can go wrong, and the mm-hmm. DNA will help us know when it has gone wrong. And it's also potentially useful in cultures and societies where there aren't good written records.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
And so
for within one of the, I know that within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the tradition is that there ought not be any fundamental incompatibility between science and faith. And in a certain sense, if there is, then there's a misunderstanding on one side or the other.
Right.
And that is a kind of a different approach to the science-religion question than either Protestant or evangelical Christians have had. It's just a much more dynamic, integrative approach. How has it been for you coming out of that tradition to walk into this space as a scientist?
Yeah. So yes, those sentiments are mine, that if there are misunderstandings, one way or another, we will reconcile them. I think about within my faith, there's a somewhat famous scientist named Henry Eyring, who is the father of President Henry B. Eyring, who the latter of whom is a first counselor. He's basically in the highest ranking body mm-hmm. of the church, and So his father was a very famous chemist, a physical chemist who, you know, some feel could have received the Nobel Prize. And before the elder Henry Eyring went off to college, his dad said to him, "This church doesn't require you to believe anything that isn't true." Right? Mm. So I've read lectures that he's given, this chemist, about his faith, and he'll say to people, "You go find out what's true, and that's what you should believe." You know, and sort of, in some sense, if you found the truth, embrace it.
And if it doesn't, if it works, it's likely true. And if it doesn't work, then you need to find something else. But it puts you in a sense of, with a sense of agency for your own life.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And that sense of, so this is, I'm going to tie this back. Having that sense of agency where you are to discover the life that you live also is a tremendous antidote to depression.
Sure, sure, absolutely. Yeah, feeling that you're in control.
Or that you have some responsibility, some capacity. Yeah. Not total control, but yeah.
That you can contribute to life.
Substantially.
In some way, yeah. Yeah, I feel like that's one of the reasons, that, I feel like depression can be cyclical. You start out with some negative feelings, and then because you're down, you're not able to contribute as well, and that just makes things worse,
right?
And, yeah, absolutely.
So what kinds of genetic relationships are you looking at? What kinds of connections are you looking at in your work?
Yeah, so all kinds. At some level, really, really distant relatives. So, we'll say to people, well, we're all related. Right. And it's true, if we go back far enough, right?
But are you talking about like 6th, 8th, or 10th cousins? Or are you talking about, hundreds of years ago?
Right. So as much as we can is the answer. But for reliably saying how people are related, it depends on how reliable you want it to be. But we're talking, like third cousin. You can detect relationships that are more distant than that. And you can actually, many sixth cousins, about 90%, don't share any DNA. But for the 10% that do, you can actually be able to say, okay, you're related. But you can't say, you're sixth cousin. You can say, there's something back there somewhere, but
so
we're not sure where.
So in a certain sense, 23andMe, when they says you that you're a fifth or sixth cousin, they're overstating what they know.
I know that these companies divide this up. They try to be fairly conservative. They'll give you ranges instead of saying it's a sixth cousin. They'll say it's in a range,
And having done this testing in the last year, I have like 1,500 people in the database that I am somewhere between a niece who is in the database and I think sixth is the most distant cousin they will number.
That's right.
But because we have family reunions where we would be connected to people who might even be our seventh cousins, I actually would have known them because this was a family that got together on a fairly regular basis.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's neat. So it is complicated. It gets a lot less certain what the relationship is as you get more distant, but it's still possible.
And why does this work matter?
Yeah, so it matters to me and to those of my religion because, and I want to talk some about why it might matter to people of other beliefs as well. But as I know that you know, but just to make sure everybody's on the same page, we believe that in order to make it to heaven, we all need to be baptized by proper authority. And so one question that people will sometimes ask is, what do we say as Christians? If we believe that baptism is essential, what about those, let's say, the canonical example, what about those in China that lived in the Middle Ages in China?
Right.
They never even heard of Jesus Christ, much less had the opportunity to be baptized. Does that mean that they're just going to go to hell and that's that? It seems fundamentally unjust if that's how it is.
Right.
And so our answer is baptism is still essential. But the answer is vicarious baptism. So in our temples, and we're very public about this, in our temples, people can go, and I've done this, and be baptized in behalf of someone else. Mm-hmm. Now, people start to get uncomfortable with this sometimes because what about the choice of that person? What if they don't want to be baptized?
Right, right. And particularly where it would involve a conversion from Judaism to Christianity or from Islam or from some other, you know, practice that they were deeply steeped in.
That's right. That's right.
Committed to.
That's right. And our answer to that is this is not a forced conversion. We don't count them as members of our church. It is giving those people the opportunity to accept that baptism, that ordinance, should they choose. Mm-hmm. So that's in some ways empowering them. You could think of it as these individuals, there's in our view sort of a door that's locked that
right.
they can't get through, and this baptism, this vicarious baptism, unlocks the door and they get to choose whether or not to enter. So that's fundamentally why, one of the main reasons I do this work. But, right. I was just at this genealogy conference called Roots Tech and met a woman that I'm fairly certain wasn't of my faith. And she is the daughter of an adopted woman. Mm-hmm. And she showed me, okay, here's my mom and here's two people that might be her half-siblings, but they could also be her niece and nephew, or right. they could be her aunts and uncles. Can you help me? And it turns out we've got some software that we've developed that can help. And so actually just since that meeting, which happened a week and a half ago, I've been in my spare time starting to put up a website so that, we've got this software that's out there, but you kind of have to know how to, you have to be somewhat advanced with computers to be able to use it. And so we're going to make it so that it's available to anyone that might be like this woman, then
sure.
have DNA from these people and not know quite how to pin down just how are they related. Can
right.
we get names associated with my adopted mother's parents?
Right, right, right.
So,
and we'll come back to this. I want to go back to, it's awkward.
Yeah.
It's awkward to know how to wish what one holds as the very best for an other who may not hold it.
Yep.
And we, when we greet each other with words of may you have a blessed fast during Ramadan, or may you have a Merry Christmas, or may you have an easy fast on Yom Kippur. When we greet each other, we can say these things to others in their words, but sometimes it's important for us to give others what we would value,
sure.
whether they can choose it or not, which is in effect what I see you doing in that that form of baptism. What was the word you used?
Vicarious
baptism. It allows people to offer what they believe to be critical, even though the person who's receiving it may not never ever choose or agree.
Yeah,
and it's creating a bit of a cosmology. It's creating a bit of a myth, but it allows for people to work in these awkward spaces with integrity for their values.
Yeah.
And we don't think those kinds of issues through very carefully.
Right. Yeah, it's easy. And I don't mean to apply this and say other people should only feel this way about
sure.
what we're doing.
Right, right.
But I think it's easy to see the world as we see the world, right?
Right.
It's almost,
most of us think that way.
Right. It's almost like almost impossible not to understand the world as you understand the world, right? But
except it's not the same way I understood it yesterday or 5 or 10 years ago.
That's right. That's right. But to try to empathize and understand the heart of those that are trying to do good, right? And mm-hmm. This has relevance, to all kinds of conflicts in the world, to try and put ourselves in the shoes of these other people that are maybe, trying to get their own needs met, maybe mm-hmm. trying to do good to people, even though we may not agree with the means that they're using, right?
Right, right. Right. Yeah. But it's an olive branch.
Right.
Or an unlocking of a door.
Yeah.
A refusal to have an absolute boundary.
That's right.
But not but not demanding anything of the other.
Right.
And that's a subtle, mature way of being in difference that we often don't get to because we don't get past the sound bites or the kind of absolute rights.
Yeah. And it's especially hard if critics are the ones explaining a religion.
That's true.
I mean, we have to get a balanced view somehow, but if all we do is listen to critics, then we may not actually hear the real reasons why people are doing things and such.
Right. And let me just pause here for 1 second. One of the things that's been striking in my own looking at genetic history is we have a history of clotting disorders in my family, which I actually inherited some of them. We don't know exactly how many of them yet because I'm not able to do all the testing just yet. But it's likely to have been marked at least 4 generations of my ancestors.
Wow.
And that's pretty major. And if we can follow that through, we learn how to take care of ourselves a little differently, just health-wise.
Right.
But I hear from what you're saying, you're thinking more in terms of the relationships of individuals and groups more than necessarily the health benefits of the genetics.
Yeah. So I've done work in the past. When I was a postdoc, I did work on type 2 diabetes.
Right.
And we found it was one of the biggest studies in Latinos for type 2 diabetes. It's unfortunately very common in Latinos. And we found a risk factor that's pretty sizable. Makes you about 25% more likely to develop type 2 diabetes. And I know it's been followed up on. And I continue to think that health-related, you know, we would call it phenotypic, the sort of trait-related studies are extremely important. And the tools that we're developing are useful in that domain. They're not exclusively for, we might call it genetic genealogy, mm-hmm. but they're useful in both spaces. And it's wonderful, and there's tons of great people working on that. And in some ways, one of the challenges of being a scientist is that there's so many talented people all wanting to do something of impact and importance that distinguishing yourself and finding a domain where you can get access to good data and mm-hmm. make a valuable contribution and not just be one of, you know, way too many people working on the same thing is a challenge. And it feels like this domain is worked on by other people as well. And at the same time, we're... it's not nearly as crowded in some ways as some of these trait related studies.
Yes. But also it allows you to frame relationships in some new ways.
And
one of the pieces that came from my own genetic profiling was that I have an ancestor from the Congo.
Oh, wow.
From the 18th century, which means that, slave, in all likelihood, a woman, I would guess. But it also helps me to understand some of the ways in which stories have traveled through my family and defensiveness and certain religious affiliations that we had, because it was within a group where that kind of intermarriage might have been more likely, or at least mixed race people would have been more welcome and tolerated in the lead up to the Civil War. It helps me just understand a whole host of issues by having that little piece of data. And I wonder whether it will ever become more specific. Yeah.
So it turns out we had no idea, but it turns out this is going to sound teeny, and mm-hmm. the truth is it is, but
right.
I'm 1% African.
Right.
But the way that DNA gets transmitted, it's actually in these two fairly sizable chunks of DNA, and it's very clearly, you know, Sub-Saharan African ancestry, almost certainly same story as you, like mm-hmm. a slave, mixture of probably a slave owner and a slave. And somehow that information hadn't come down to us.
For various reasons.
For various reasons. Maybe somebody, right. you know, there. Who knows?
It was more possible to be open about mixed race ancestry and also mixed status in the period leading up to the Civil War. And then after the Civil War, with the even more rigidification of racial categories, then it became almost impossible. So that's what I'm that's where I would put that marker.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
But let's cut to music, and then we'll come to the last segment of the show. What should we play next?
Let's play the Pilgrim Song.
Okay. Here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Amy Williams. So, Amy, the way we close the last segment of the show, and we've got about 13 minutes here, what do you do to take care of yourself physically, emotionally, intellectually, throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, and how do you know you need to do it? Mm. And maybe if it helps, you know, when did you figure out or how are you figuring out? Because some of us figure this out late in life, that self-care is kind of our number one job in order to be, it's like put the oxygen mask on yourself so you can be, do good or help for others. So,
Yeah. So, you know, every morning I, religiously, study the scriptures and, mm-hmm. and pray. I found that if I don't, some of those heavy feelings come back very readily. And
when you study, is it the first thing you do, or is it, how long do you spend?
Yeah, so it used to be that I would check my email first and, mm-hmm. and maybe do a few other things. And I found that that primes my mind to jump around and stuff, right?
Yeah, yep,
and so...
Yep.
So I've taken away the notifications, so they're just not there. Like, I'll look at my phone to see what time it is and such, but, you know, basically that's the top of my list. And, and you asked how long.
And how long.
So, so I don't think that my way of life needs to be anybody else's, but I spend a half hour pretty much every day,
right,
with a few exceptions, studying the scriptures and then, you know, time in prayer after that. Mm-hmm. And it just really grounds me. And I find that it's very easy, you know, as I came out of the depression, some anxiety started to come up. And it's very easy for me to worry and to want to try and control things and mm-hmm. use my sort of physical might to, you know, and when I say physical, I don't just mean like my arms.
Use your intentionality.
Yes, my will.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
And
will is the better word. Yes.
For sure, right. But there's merit to I mean, we need to use our wills, mm-hmm. but it seems to be much more effective for me to maintain throughout the day a spiritual connection to God, and in doing so, I feel calmer, and I feel like, you know, thoughts come to my mind that, you know, it's hard to say, but it seems right. like they wouldn't come otherwise.
Right. And do you and what sorts of scriptural texts do you read from?
Yeah, so main focus is the Book of Mormon,
mm-hmm.
but also the Bible, Old and New Testament. Mm-hmm. There's other scriptures that we have. So Joseph Smith, the founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, had revelations that have been written down and canonized in what's called the Doctrine and Covenants.
Mm-hmm, right.
So I'll read from kind of all of those,
sure.
Book of Mormon every day and the others very regularly, mm-hmm. and frequently.
And one of the things, there was a study back in the late 80s, early 90s of older people, and one of the biggest indications of how they were coping in later years was if they read scripture or really powerful literature.
Yeah.
So those who read, and the thing about the Psalms is that the Psalms are like this huge emotional workout with vengeance and love and affection and hatred and violence and tenderness and all of this stuff. And even in the same chapter.
Yeah.
And what I always surmised was that when people are meditating on that array of life, it keeps them more nimble.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, part of what you're saying and part of what I hear in people who have that practice is it just reminds them that the universe is bigger than my particular place in it.
Right.
And you start every day that way or with some form of practice or early. At this point, I read the paper.
Yeah.
I read news for about an hour, but I meditate and pray on it. It's not just to gather information.
Mm-hmm.
So I spend an hour every day. That's how I start my day. I might, and even before I do any work email, is that same sort of centering piece. But I build it around news.
Yeah.
But with a spiritual, meditative, prayerful.
That's great. Yeah.
Fix.
Yeah. No, I mean, it seems... it's just so easy, you know. I feel like all of us have things we want to accomplish in life,
mm-hmm.
and it's so easy to let those, you know, and hopefully most of those things are good. Most of those mm-hmm. things we are, at least our heart's in the right place. And at the same time, even when those things are good,
they become obsessions.
They can become in some ways, yeah, like a false, what I might think of as like a false God.
Right.
Yep. For me, it helps to remember who's really in charge and what really matters, right? It's not going to matter so much if this paper, you know, for my work doesn't come out before my competitors, right? Or something like this. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And it's holding on to the fullness of what's real. rather than what we put in the place of what's real, which is the traditional definition of idolatry.
Mm, right.
You put something, some expectation, some image, some hope,
yep,
that is not whole, not real, but it becomes, you focus on it as though it were,
right,
rather than being open to all the negative and other positive and feedback and the experiences of others that are just completely out of our lives.
Right, right.
So that's a good kind of grounding, meditative, emotional. What do you do in terms of physical work, exercise, or food, or?
Yeah. So I bike to work most days, mm-hmm, not every day. And I try to eat a balanced diet. I'm not a vegetarian, but I sort of am, like, often, like, 6 days a week.
Right. Right.
And you know, try to get good healthy food, and you know, I feel like making sure that I guess my struggles have mostly been psychological. Not that I have no physical suffering,
sure,
you know, or struggles, but I feel like if I'm maintaining, when I say psychological, I also mean spiritual, mm-hmm, right? And so making sure to find the right balance between, I think something that needs to be mentioned in this domain is service, you know, mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm, it's the case that for me to come out of depression, I had to learn that it's not all about me, and that, yes, you know,
otherwise you're just more depressed.
Yeah, exactly. And that if I will, certainly take care of myself in the ways we're talking about, but also devote even kind of a sizable fraction of time to doing service at my church and doing service otherwise, mm-hmm, that really seems to bring a strength with it.
So what about those service activities bring you out of yourself? What are you doing?
Yeah. So in, you know, it seems like it helps me. I almost feel like it's sort of beyond what it seems on the surface.
Sure.
If I'll sacrifice an hour of a day to go talk with someone that might be struggling, or you know, any number of other things, go, mm-hmm, to church to be with the youth group or whatever, it gives me energy. And I'm not sure exactly how to answer the, you know, it seems like it, there's not a real physical explanation.
Well, or that just the act of engaging other people, you know, you see their eyes, you touch, I mean, and you behold them, they behold you, you respond. It's a whole dance.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's a spiritual thing with those other people, and I feel like it synergizes as God enters the picture as well.
And in terms of getting together with people in a non, just to be with people, what is the role of friendship in your life, or kind of group activity?
Yeah. So
you're single, and you're teaching at Cornell, and yeah, that's a lot of work.
Yeah. And yeah, it would be easy to be totally consumed by that. But I would be totally ineffective if
if you let it happen.
Yeah. I mean, I'll get together with friends. This isn't the only thing, but commonly have, mm-hmm, people over, go to other people's houses for dinner on Sundays. And spend time sometimes with coworkers, including students, like, mm-hmm, getting dinner out and such. And I'll go visit my family as well out in Utah. And it is definitely essential to maintain those connections.
Sure.
and engage with people in deeper ways. Yeah.
So, Amy, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Yeah, thanks.
And you wanted to close with Brian Stokes Mitchell's rendition of The Impossible Dream from The Man of La Mancha. Why did you pick that song?
So, as I mentioned, I feel like all of us, I don't know if I quite said it this way, I feel like all of us have things that we want to be different in the world.
Sure.
And this was a song that my grandfather, who had polio when he was a kid, was a child, and was really mistreated by peers as a result, but sought to
do
good.
Did he recover some of his function? And
yeah, but he was crippled right. throughout his life, and he worked in radio and mm-hmm. television, and he wanted information to be in the hands of people. He wanted the truth to be available with a broad capital mm-hmm. and lowercase t,
sure.
you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And for him, this song was very meaningful. And I've always found it very meaningful, you know, and I think pretty much all of us can relate. It's just such a passionate piece.
Yes, yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Quest. What does that mean, quest?
It is the mission of each true knight. His duty, nay, his privilege, to dream the impossible dream. To fight the unbeatable foe. To bear with unbearable sorrow. To run where the brave dare not go. To right the unrightable wrong. To love pure and chaste from afar. To try when your arms are too weary. To reach the unreachable star. This is my quest, to follow that star. No matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to fight for the right, without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will lie peaceful and calm when I'm laid to my rest, and the world will be better for this, that one man scorned and covered with scars still strove with his last ounce of courage to the unreachable stars. This is my quest.